Steve Byrne is a longtime stand-up comedian, actor, and director. As a stand-up, you can actually check him out here in Austin this weekend. He is headlining at Creek in the Cave Friday and Saturday. That's February 9th and 10th. Two shows each night, 7 and 9. Go to creekandcave.com for info and tickets. Steve, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you, Trey. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So I just found out before we hit record that you were in Austin shortly after things started to open up from the pandemic a few years ago, playing at Vulcan Gas Company back then. You're going to be coming back to Creek in the Cave now. Austin, in that time, has somehow turned into one of the stand-up hotspots in the country. Then again, you also moved to what is now considered a stand-up hotspot in Nashville as well. For somebody who has been performing stand-up for as long as you have, you've been through Austin time and time again. Does it surprise you at all to know that Austin is this sort of stand-up mecca now?
Yeah, look, it is surprising. I think it's always been a market associated with music. And so I wouldn't think Austin would be on the map for comedy at all, because, you know, it's always been New York, Comedy Cellar and the other clubs, and then it's LA, Comedy Store and the other clubs, and Improv, I should say. But to know that Austin has blossomed into this scene, you know, it literally just boils down to one name, and that's Joe Rogan. You know, you get the biggest comedy podcast, or literally the biggest podcast in the world, and he wants to settle roots there. And then he brings, you know, a collection of all these great comics that are willing to like roll the dice on themselves out of Los Angeles, out of the Comedy Store. I mean, half the Comedy Store left to go to Rogan. So like the employees. So it's to see that it's, I think really at the end of the day, it's just an acknowledgement of like the drawing power and the significance and gravity that Joe Rogan has, not only in the podcast world, but absolutely and certainly in the comedy world. I think, you know, Dave Chappelle's trying to do that in Yellow Springs, Ohio, but I just don't think, I think that's going to be a destination where comics go and do sets, but like people have moved to Austin. That's a huge difference. And so, you know, I'm not knocking Chappelle or anything. I'm just saying that, you know, there's comics that are trying to set up these camps now, and you're seeing what Rogan has done and accomplished. It really is. I've never seen it in the comedy world at all. It's pretty wild.
Is there somebody that qualifies as that person in Nashville? Because I feel like there have been people who established their roots in Nashville over the years. You're there now, obviously. I'm guessing Zany's is where you go to work out a lot of material, but you're to the point where you're probably working things out on stage when you're traveling across the country as well. Was there that initiator on the Nashville side of things?
Look, I mean, there's such a, it's like there's Rogan, then there's like everybody else, right? And there's like five notches below, because what he's done and accomplished, I mean, he's built his own club, and that club's been massively successful. And through the influx of all the comedians coming for the opportunity and looking for the outreach that Rogan has, you know, they're hoping to get on that podcast. They're hoping to buddy up with him. They're hoping to be on Kill Tony. They're hoping to do all these things, right? That are based out of Austin. So I think there's like Austin, then there's like everybody else, right? I think it goes, it's still New York, it's still LA, and now Austin on the map, and then it's everybody else after that. I think Nashville will never be the scene that any of those things are. I think Nashville's just a great place to raise a family. That's why I moved here, right? Nobody's like moving here for comedy. People are moving here for a better quality of life. So if I were to say, why are people here? It's like, for me, it's Nate. Let's see. Like Nate was very instrumental. And I remember going out to lunch with him in Philadelphia. We're both there years ago, both doing comedy clubs. And he's doing theaters and arenas now, and I'm still in comedy clubs. So that tells you something. But Nate was very, very cool about like telling me about Nashville and putting the seed in my head. Then pandemic hits. My wife and I never loved LA. We always liked LA, but then I was like, well, let's check out Nashville. And that's exactly what we did. And within months of pandemic hitting, we moved here and have never looked back and love it. But it is a good scene for sure. I mean, new talent showcases, you're going to go see Nate, you'll see Theo Vaughn, you'll see Dusty Slay, you'll see me. Angela Johnson just moved here. Kathy Madigan lives here. So it's a good core of comics. But I wouldn't say by any means we're all bowling on the weekends together, you know? Whereas like in Austin, like everybody's at the mothership because all those guys are a lot younger. They're single. They don't have families. So it's just a different confluence of personalities.
Yeah, that makes sense. By the same token, though, I heard you on the Drinking Bros podcast back in 2019, and you were talking about moving to Nashville then. And a big part of the reason is you have two kids. What are your kids' ages now?
11 and 8.
Okay, I've got a 9 and 7 year old, so we're on a very
Oh.
similar timeline in terms of
Heck
how
yeah.
beholden we are to these little humans, you know?
That's right. Yes. That's really why I did it. I mean, Los Angeles, I can't begin to describe just how it's almost like you're in another, I don't know. It's like you're not living in this country almost. There's just like parents don't hang out like they do. Like we open our doors here and the kids just go outside and play. Like in LA, it's like regimented. You got to set up a play date and no kids really play in the neighborhood. It's weird. It's just weird. The schools are out of control and just the traffic's horrendous. I used to, when I did my movie, The Opening Act, not to bring that up, but it's just example, LA. I lived in Pasadena. I had to go out to Venice to go edit this thing. And for I think about 4 or 5 months, I would have to travel 2 hours to get there and 2 hours to come back, and sometimes it'd be 2.5. I mean, that's 4 or 5 hours sometimes just in the car to get to an edit bay. And I after doing that for like 4 or 5 months, I wanted to kill myself. And I was like, I think that was a big reason why I was like, I gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, you know, I feel you on that too, because we had our first when we were living in Chicago, and we were in Chicago proper at the time. And it's like, there's no way in hell we want to
Oh
raise
God.
kids in the city proper. And this was back in 2014, 2015. There's no
Yeah.
way in hell we want to raise our kids in Chicago proper. And if we move to the suburbs, it's like, what's the point of living in Chicago at that point? Because how often are you going to be making it back into the city to go along with the brutal winters as well? So you try and find some
Right.
place that is comparable in terms of the cool points, but is much lower on that BS, I guess. Now that you're someplace where you do feel more comfortable with your kids playing outside, what do you think the biggest challenge is with raising kids in 2024? Because there are a couple of different directions we could go here.
You're right. That you could go a million different ways. I think I'll be honest with you. I think one of the biggest reasons why we moved out of California, Los Angeles was we're pretty, my wife and I are pretty straight down the middle. I think when people watch my comedy, they're going to hear something that offends them and they go, oh, he's conservative. And then they're going to hear something else and go, oh, he's a socialist. It's like you're only hearing what you want to remember, right? But for us, we're pretty centrist and we sway one way on this, one way on that, but boy, the identity politics in Los Angeles were driving us both crazy. And having kids in school at the time, especially with all like the hammering of sexuality and trans and all this other stuff, it's just like, look, I'm not gonna tell my kids like Michael Jackson, right? I'm not gonna tell my kids like what Michael Jackson did and why people don't really like Michael Jackson or why he comes with an asterisk. It's like because they're too young. Like they're too young to understand that. So it's like every time they ask for Michael Jackson, I'm like, okay, they're like, Dad, don't you like Michael? I'm like, I like Michael Jackson, but what's wrong? Well, I'll tell you when you get older, right? So I think it's like it's the same thing with that stuff. And so California, that's an example of like why we want to get out of there. It's just like I don't think our kids in second grade need to know this stuff. And so that was a big thing because my wife's a fifth grade teacher. Prior to meeting me, and she's like, I was like, when do they do like sex ed? She's like, sixth grade. I'm like, yeah, that's probably a good time to do it. So do it then. But my daughter at the time was, third grade or something like that. This is bananas. Like, I don't know. Another example of like not living in this country. It's like, I want to get out of here. So that's to answer your question. I'm trying to be as politically correct, I guess, as I can, but fuck that shithole.
Well, I feel like also, like, not only is that a big part of the challenge, but then you have the whole technology and dietary things to go along with, too. Like, you take your kids someplace in public at a restaurant, they have the kids' menu and then they have the human food menu, because the kids' menu always consists of quesadillas, chicken fingers,
Yes.
like a cheese or pepperoni pizza. And just straight up garbage that the kids are being given options with versus forcing them to eat something off of the adult menu, if you will. That's still good food. It just doesn't cater to their most basic sensibilities with regards to what they want to eat.
The public schools too, like in California, by the way, I am a comedian. This is that we've gone down a real tangent, but the public schools, if you're sending your kids to public school, which I think my wife and I did, planning that our daughter hits junior high school, my son hits junior high school. Okay, we're going to have to pay to get them a private school because it's like, okay. And then all of a sudden the grading of the public schools dips down. It was the school system we were at was a 2 out of 10, the public school system, once you get to sixth grade. So we're like, okay, we got to send her to private school. And then to send her to private school, you don't just send her to private school. It's like, oh, you got to interview. You've got to send a letter. You got to pay for it. And these private schools are as much as a college tuition. Like when I was in college, like Kent State, it was as much as that, if not more, depending on the ones you want to go to. So you have to hope you get in through the lottery. Then you hope you get passed. Then you get them in. That's just the beginning. Then there's all these fundraisers that you have to do for the kids. And they're just constantly gouging these parents. They don't, you know, and so the public school, even we went, no school buses in California. You have to drive your kids to school. So it's like, you're the fifth largest economy. You brag about all this stuff. And then I moved to Nashville, and now my daughter and son are in a school system that's ranked 9 out of 10. Public school system. These kids go to school with, Tennessee Titans kids and country music stars kids. So I think, again, that's something where you don't really think about at the time, but all these parents are living in a township and pooling their resources to make the public school as great and as efficient as possible. And I think that's what should be happening. But in LA, it's like, no, fuck it. I'm well off. We all are in the film or TV industry. So we're going to pull our money and pull it out of the public schools and send our kids to a private school and pay for it. And the public schools can go fuck themselves. I mean, that's really what it is. So another example, like I could go down the rabbit and the guy's taking shits in the middle of the street. I mean, you know, I had a bit in one of my specials about homeless guy hitting on my wife while he's taking a shit. It's like, this is a crazy, crazy place. I think the fuck out of here.
Wait a second. What is the line that is being given by somebody who is dropping a number two as they're trying to hit on your wife?
He's squatting in the middle of the sidewalk on 9th and Hope, where we lived. And he looks at my wife and he goes, well, hello, beautiful. And my wife's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, we're going to go to eat lunch. And then we go to eat lunch. And I can't stop laughing at lunch. And she is definitely not eating. And I'm wolfing down my food. She's like, I've lost my appetite. And then we're walking back home to go home. And she's like, let's go around this block in case he's here. I'm like, oh, we're fucking walking straight down this block. And then he's getting arrested and we discover he's got no pants, but he's yelling at the cops like, fuck you, motherfuckers. You don't know the fuck. And then he sees my wife again. He sees her again. And he looks at her and goes, well, hello again. And she's like, oh, Jesus Christ. So that was our homeless taking a shit in the middle of. But that, again, the homelessness in California is real. Like my good friend, Peter Billingsley from A Christmas Story. He used to live off the Gower exit off the 101. Now, when you get off the Gower exit, that takes you up into the hills. And that's where, like, throw a rock. You're gonna hit a celebrity's house, right? So every time I'd go off that exit, it was like the gateway to the hills. And to the Hollywood sign, for that matter, too. You could hike up to the Hollywood sign off that exit. So it's a very popular area. And I remember when I was going, just before I moved, I was like, oh, I'm going to go hike the Hollywood sign one last time. And I get off the exit and there's all these tents. Not only tents, they had a wash station and they had a latrine. So any other city would be like, all right, we got to clean this up. There's rich people here. The rich people don't want this eyesore. They don't want to be around it. But the city was saying, make yourself comfortable. Take a shit. Right there, not on the sidewalk, right on the sidewalk in this porta potty, off like Hollywood and La Cienega. There's like this six-way kind of intersection, and they have a telephone pole. And there was a guy that hacked into the light post and had literally built a shed on there, and a homeless guy, there was all these tents, but he had running electricity and he was living in a shed that he built on the, like that, that's like living in Times Square. That's by the Beverly Center. That's how fucking crazy California is. And everybody was like putting up with it. And I was like, this is not normal. I got to get the hell out of here. So moved here. And just, this is the last thing I'll say. When we moved to this area, there's this, in the middle of the town square of Franklin, there's a, like a Confederate statue, right? Some military guy from the Confederacy. And at the time, like all the BLM stuff was happening. And I told my real estate agent, I go, you know, I'm coming from Los Angeles. We're gonna have to tear that statue down. She goes, you try to pull that statue down, you're gonna have 35 shotguns coming in on you at one moment. And I was like, I forgot everybody's packing heat. She's like, I'm packing heat. I'm like, what? And she pulls out a purse and she got a gun. I was like, Jesus Christ, like this place is, I mean, there's like this pendulum, like, you know, societal norms. But, you know, I guess I'll take it. I'll take that over like all the other shit that's going on in California.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a culture shock. I'm glad you mentioned your friend Peter, because you guys did a fantastic job in the second season of his podcast, The Cinematic Christmas Journey. You were the co-host all throughout season two. I don't know if you're going to be back for season three, but you guys are basically just breaking down Christmas movies. You're talking to with people who were a part of those Christmas movies. Actually, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was a part of the conversation, technically a Thanksgiving movie. And I love how season two ended with Die Hard, which you talked to the cinematographer from Die Hard. And at the end of that conversation, look, I've always been a Die Hard as a Christmas movie guy. Mm-hmm. I've never had it put as succinctly to me as to why it is a Christmas movie versus how Peter put it at the end. I had already always taken it at surface value. It's like, look, this is a Christmas party. If the Christmas party's not happening, the movie's not happening. It's
sure,
a completely
course, yeah.
different movie. But he took it to like two and three levels deep to explain why it is, in fact, a Christmas movie, to the degree that the cinematographer for Die Hard, who has this extensive list of credits, was like, you know what? You're right. It is a Christmas movie.
Yeah, Jan de Bont, who I think most people know him from directing Speed and Twister and a ton of films, but he was the DP on that one. But to your point, you're absolutely right. I mean, that was not a surface type, you know, mental floss podcast. That was a deep dive. Yeah. And if anybody can understand the DNA of what makes a great Christmas film, it's Peter Billingsley. I mean, he's been in Elf. He's been, you know, the face of Christmas Story. He did Four Christmases. So if anybody knows the ingredients to a great Christmas story, it is absolutely Peter. But he took that same attention and care to the podcast. And I mean, these things, dives, I know they seem like quick hits, but I cannot tell people how much research we did on those films. But we did the research on the films, A, because we were fans of the film and the genre, but also we wanted to make sure we were respectful to every guest we had. I mean, we had some heavy hitters. Paul Hirsch, whose book I just finished over there, he edited Star Wars.
Wow.
The original Star Wars, he edited that, and then he edits Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and he edits Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So to your point, when somebody like that comes in, you're not like, so how was the flight? You know, you want to be like really prepared. And Peter was such a great partner, I would say leader on this, in terms of like making sure we were on point, we knew our stuff, we had it together, and that's why the podcast was as successful as it was during the holiday season. And we just finished doing an adventure series for Spotify. So we're doing like Raiders and all these kind of fun adventure films. And we'll see if we get to do another Christmas run too. I'm not sure how many great Christmas films there are left to be mine. I'm sure there'll be, you know, at least another season or two, but he's just a great dude, a really, really great guy, not only to work with, but to kick a few back with every now and then. He moved to Idaho actually, from California. So he's in Boise.
Good for him. Boise is one of those Nashville, Austin, Denver, can't really put on that list anymore, but one of those types of places now. And Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is one of the all-time underrated comedies, holiday or not. Is there something that you learned about the making of that film from having that conversation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many things to glean from any one of these, you know. But the thing I found fascinating was that John Hughes, who you think, I mean, he's John Hughes, he doesn't need any help. He writes an ending. The whole, you know, it doesn't matter how film begins. Obviously, you need the setup to work, right? But the ending is the payoff. And people remember the ending. That's why films live in the pantheon of great films. And his ending for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was not working. People were laughing at it. Because what happened is Martin goes and has a conversation with Dell. And he's kind of tearing into him, but then realizes, okay, he's got no place to go. So this conversation happens. Dell kind of breaks down. Dell's like getting emotional. And people are laughing at John Candy in the test screenings. Those guys are too busy. You can't reshoot an ending. John Hughes has literally weeks to figure this out before it's to be released. So he's fucked. I mean, he's genuinely fucked. And him, Paul Hirsch, the editors, they're just sitting there and they're going, what the hell do we do? And it's like, well, Steve Martin's going to figure it out. Whoever said it in the edit bay. So they took edits before they're filming. Okay. You're setting the camera up and Steve Martin's just kind of sitting there. They're like, all right, Steve, we're ready. And you, okay, here we go. So while he's daydreaming, just a few seconds before that, they're like, all right, take that snippet of him daydreaming and then take a snippet of him doing this and take to him, and then he's making the crew laugh right before the take. He's making the crew laugh and he's joking. He's like, ah, Steve, ready? Okay. They took that part where he's laughing to himself after a joke he made, and they're taking it and all these little pieces. They now created a montage where Steve Martin is backtracking and almost like Kaiser Soze putting it together. Oh, he said this. Oh, he said that. He made me laugh there. Oh my God. Holy shit. His wife's dead. And then he goes to the train station and says, come on, that's it. There's no dialogue. There's nothing. But Steve Martin, now the audience understand, they piece it together along with him. Now you solve the mystery that Del Griffith's wife is dead and he has nobody else. And that's why he's so forthcoming, so outgoing, and so wants to be his friend because he has nobody else. When's the last time you were home? Well, I've been home in years. Like, take that, put that in there, right? So all these breadcrumbs. And you think John Hughes, wow, he wrote an ending that you would think worked, but even him and they solved the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's one of the most impactful endings to a film. And that's why it's so resonant. And that's why that theme that is so much more resonant because of the theme that Peter was talking about being home with your family, love for the family, the holidays, wanting to get together. So it's all there. But that to me was very, very shocking to hear that, you know, such a genius like John Hughes, even in the edit bay, needed to fix something and tweak something.
You know, I'm glad that you and I have a chance to talk because in doing prep, I came across a couple of movies of yours that I didn't realize that you had directed. One is Always Amazing, a mm-hmm. documentary on the amazing Jonathan, rest in peace. And the other is The Opening Act, which is a stand-up comedy film based on your early experiences as a stand-up. And I feel like you and John Hughes have a similar quality with your films based on the fact that they're not only funny, but there's also a genuine, heartfelt nature to them as well. And that's not to say that you're aiming to make a John Hughes film whenever you do those sorts of things, but it comes across as that. So congratulations on those things.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think if I had the opportunity, well, first off, like the Jonathan doc, which is on YouTube for free, you can check it out. It's always amazing. It's, look, for those that know Jonathan, Jonathan was an incredibly talented comedian magician, more so comedian than magician, but really raw, really raw, really low. He's not there to be your friend. He is going to fuck with you. And he passed. He knew he had an expiration date, but he was doing one last tour. And I thought, wow, what a great entry into a doc. But the doc at the end of the day, to your point, was really about a relationship between this magician and this kid he took under his wing named Joel Osborne, who wanted to be a stand-up. And this relationship of two people on paper that shouldn't be friends, but somehow this incredible bond formed between these two guys. And Jonathan became a father figure for him. And Joel essentially was a caretaker for a drug addict. I mean, you got an 18-year-old kid moving from Australia to Las Vegas in charge of a guy who's like till 7 in the morning doing coke and hooking up with hookers and all this stuff. And an 18-year-old kid who doesn't drink, it's like he's babysitting him. And Jonathan says, if it wasn't for him, I'd be dead. Like it's a really crazy film. So that doc happened. We actually wrote a script based on it, and that'll be the next one I do after this next one. This next one I'm doing is about Caltech's basketball program, because I did the opening act, and I was like, if I'm going to do this, keep it grounded, make it realistic, and pay credence and homage to literally what is happening, you know, at somebody's career, the beginning of a stand-up. It is the most difficult, arduous part of any occupation, right? You're taking a lump. So I took all those lessons a young comic learns the first time on the road and crammed it into one weekend. So Jimmy O Yang, who plays like a younger version of me, is just getting hammered and hammered and hammered. And the light at the end of the tunnel is just getting that one slight win at the end, give you enough fuel to make it to the next weekend. And then learning upon all those lessons. So that's the core of the opening act. And that you can rent. It's like $2 on iTunes or Amazon, and highly rated. And again, you know, it comes out at a time when pandemic hits. It's like, you know, the fortunate thing is you get to make a film. The unfortunate thing is there's a global pandemic. And, you know, the two things I make, you know, no film premiere, no big night out, you know, just like video on demand.
That was maddening to me to learn when it came out. When I saw 2020, I'm like, this is why I never heard about this movie. I hate that, because I am a huge fan of stand-up, and I would have immediately, but I don't even watch a ton of movies in the theater at this point. That's the sort of movie that I would have gone to see in the theater. And you're obviously well-respected in stand-up, and you need to look no further than the caliber of comics who were appearing in that film. Everybody from Bill Burr to Neil Brennan to Felipe Esparza, Cedric the Entertainer as well. Jimmy gives a phenomenal performance too. I hear comedians talk about from time to time early in their stand-up careers, you're toiling, you're trying to figure out what works. And it's really hard because it is a thankless gig in a lot of ways. But a lot of times comics will talk about that one bigger name who gives them, maybe it's a compliment or something, or maybe just an ego boost that really helps to push them along to further fuel that desire to make it as a stand-up. Is there someone like that for you in your stand-up career?
Well, that's kind of two-part. For me, it was always like the elder statesman at the Comedy Cellar when I passed there. It was Colin Quinn, it was Greg Giraldo, Rich Ross, Keith Robinson, Patrice O'Neill. All those guys were like, they put you through the ringer. I mean, they genuinely put you through the ringer, and it's because of those experiences you built up this tough skin. I'll never forget. I was 23. I passed at the Comedy Cellar. Was 22 at the time. I didn't even know what the Comedy Cellar was. I had no idea. I didn't know it was like the spot. Every comic wants to get in there. You audition, you're part of the club. It's like, Jesus Christ. It hit me afterwards, right? And when it hit me, maybe like a month later, because I'm 22, and on a nightly basis, Robin Williams is coming in, Seinfeld's coming in, Ray Romano's coming in, like everybody's coming in, Chappelle, Rock, like they all come there to work on stuff. Anybody was on left, and they came there, if you're a significant comedian, to work on your stuff. If you're hosting SNL, you come to work on stuff at the Cellar. It's like, that's how much it meant to the comedy world. So it hits me. I'm like, holy shit, I'm in over my head. Like, Jesus Christ, I better perform. And right when that happens, I remember going downstairs. It's like a Monday night. There's maybe 25 people in there at like 11 o'clock at night. So I get up to do my set. I'll never forget this. The front row is empty. Okay. Patrice walks in, pulls the chairs out and goes, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And one by one, Patrice sits down, Norton sits down, Voss sits down, Keith Robinson sits down. And I think it was like, you know, one other comic. Those guys, they sit down. They're all in the front row. I am absolutely sweating bullets. I'm doing my act, not only for one, all of them. And they're all sitting there and not one of them is laughing. And I am like cranking it up to 10. I'm full on energy. The audience is picking up like this is uncomfortable. I am dying. I'm absolutely dying. So I had this closing bit that they all knew that kind of made fun of me about Bruce Lee having sex. And I'm like, Bruce Lee playing with the nipple and all this stuff. And as I'm setting it up, perfect timing, of course, Patrice looks at them snaps his finger and goes, let's go. They all slowly draw their chairs out like they're synchronized, right? And walk out single file as I'm doing my closing bit. It's like somebody pulled the spine out of my back and I'm just like, I plowed through it. But man, that's one of the worst bombs I ever had in my life. But it was one of those things where I walk upstairs to the olive tree thing and I'm like, I'm going to get my shit and get the fuck out of here. So I go upstairs and then Patrice just slow claps me and then they all kind of slow clap me. I'm like, you motherfuckers. And it was like one of those things where it's like, it hurt so bad, but it was one of those things where it's like, all right, you're part of the club. Welcome to the club, kid. I was like, it was really cool at the end of the day, you know, but I didn't run out the side door. I went back upstairs. I was like, all right, I'm going to face this. And, you know, they're all going to ignore me. And they did for a sec, but Patrice gave me that slow clap. And it was one of those things where I never forgot that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, between that and the SNL demo tape story that I know you told on podcast before, I'm not going to ask for it here. I mean, I can understand how that can really thicken your skin and basically make you immune to just about anything you deal with. Certainly with a crowd that isn't responsive or maybe the occasional heckler. I mean, at that point, that's child's play for you.
Well, I mean, look, that still did hurt. The roast SNL tape. Bill Burr, who, you know, we kind of came to New York same time. I did his podcast when the film was coming out, and he was in the film, as you know. He said to this day, it's one of the if not meanest things he's ever seen in stand-up comedy, and it's all because of Bobby Kelly, who is a great friend, but what an asshole! What a fucking asshole!
All right, last thing here now, Steve, because people can see the Pirates hat on your head, they can see the Lemieux jersey in the background.
Yes,
you are a Pittsburgh guy, and that means you're a big time Pittsburgh sports fan. Where are you with Mike Tomlin right now? Because there is a big debate within the Pittsburgh community. One of my best friends is a huge Steelers fan. He's like, I just don't know anymore. He gets us to a certain point, but we're not able to get over that hump and we're not making any postseason noise. So where are you with Mike Tomlin right now with the Steelers?
Well, look, to me, it's almost like his hands are kind of tied behind his back, right? He comes in, he wins with Cowher's regime, with Cowher's guys, and essentially, I mean, maybe people don't want to hear this, but like a Roethlisberger on the decline, right? But you're not going to get rid of Ben Roethlisberger. You're tied to him. So he has that. And now you roll the dice. You got Kenny Pickett, and he didn't light it up. I mean, Roethlisberger came in as a young kid and went 13-0. And Kenny Pickett, who is not Ben Roethlisberger. Nobody is, right? And so I think he's kind of facing a dilemma right now. So, you know, it's a quarterback league, and I think until they get the right quarterback, you're gonna make do with what you got, and he's making do with what he's got. So you can only do so much, you can only expect so much from somebody who's giving you limited play. And Kenny Pickett is just, I mean, their defense is fantastic, but their offense is just not, you know, their defense was winning games for them this season, not the offense. So I think it's a very tricky situation. You can only put the blame so far. And you know, when you go in a draft, you're playing the lottery, and I don't think that they won. So I think it's going to be very season to see how far of a leash Pickett has, and then how quickly, if Mason stays with the Steelers, how soon until he comes back into the fray, because Mitch is going to be gone. So it's interesting.
You guys may have stumbled into something with Mason Rudolph. That was surprising. I watched him play a lot at Oklahoma State as a Texas Longhorns fan and somebody who watches a ton of Big 12 football. I thought he might have it at the NFL level. That wasn't the case a few years ago, but he was showing something a little bit different at the end of the season. If you were only to be able to go forward with one of those two quarterbacks next season, Rudolph or Pickett, who would you choose right now?
I mean, I would go with Rudolph, to be completely honest, to know that he's been sitting there on the bench stewing, just building up tanker fuel when you get that opportunity to go in there. He's not goofing off. He's not on the iPad. He's literally mentally pretending to be in the game. He capitulated to that. He admitted that. I mean, that's a vulnerable thing to say, to be like, I ate crow for all these years sitting on the bench. Ben wasn't as welcoming. He had all the reason to be like, fuck this. Like, I'm checking out. I'm just going to go sit in the back. I'll text my wife. You know, why? He didn't do that. He sat there on the bench and mentally pretended he was the quarterback for every play. And running through the game, he was so committed to the game. I think that does something, obviously, somebody where it's like, this guy's prepared. He's been preparing. He's been waiting for this moment. And look, you get to the playoffs, and that's your fourth game. I mean, I think he did a very, very noble job. I think the receivers dropped quite a few passes they could have caught, a few mistakes made, but I thought he did a good job. I'd ride the hot hand and then let Pickett earn again, you know?
Yeah, that was a maddening team to watch on offense this year, because George Pickens would flash these incredible plays, but then he would have these moments where it seems like he's not in the game. The running back situation was weird. Like, Jaylen Warren felt like he needed to get more carries than Najee Harris, but there was still that pretty even split with Najee starting games as well. Look, I'm rooting for you guys. I'm not a Cowboys fan, even though I'm in Cowboys country. I like the Steelers as an organization, and there are some likable guys on that team as well. And obviously, you still got it going on defensively, especially when Watt is out there and healthy. It's just a matter of figuring out that right combination on offense.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, again, you see how the team itself reacted. It's just like it was almost like an adrenaline boost. All of a sudden, Harrison, you know, Warren just kind of light up, and their running game all of a sudden takes off. I don't know that they, I don't know. There was definitely like a cancer in that room. It seems like Najee kept alluding to it. You know, if you read the tea leaves correctly, I mean, he wasn't too obvious or pointing fingers, but he was like, there's something off in this locker room. And that was the case with the Steelers. The Steelers were always, you know, a pretty first-class organization, not letting things leak out of the locker room and keeping things airtight. But I think Antonio Brown was the first to kind of like blow the doors off of that. And ever since that incident between him and Roethlisberger, it more of an open case scenario where guys will allude to what's happening, whereas like you never heard that before. So I think there is something in the culture that's permeated since AB into the Steelers locker room. But I don't know. I also love the fact that the Steelers have only had three head coaches, I mean, throughout the course of their time. And if this guy's got a winning record, I get it. It's like, but he's not winning the big games. But it's like, it's deeper than that. You got to go deeper than that. It's not just that. So I don't know. I like Tomlin. I think he's done a great job. I think it's also got to be taxing for him being with the same organization. Like, sometimes a coach does need a new change of environment, but I think Pittsburgh loves him. I think he loves Pittsburgh. I think he loves being there. And I think he's still, I think all this talk that we're talking about, I think he knows it too. You don't think that this guy's competitive. He wants another ring. He doesn't want the stigma of like, you know, I took over a Cowboys team. It's like, he wants to prove it on his own too, 100%. And I think if he wants to prove it, he's going to do it in Pittsburgh.
He is comedian Steve Byrne. Don't let the soft exterior fool you. He takes a flamethrower to the place when he's on stage. And we are lucky here in Austin, because he's going to be here in town at Creek in the Cave tomorrow and Saturday. That's February 9th and 10th. Shows at 7 and 9 o'clock. Go to creekandcave.com to snag tickets. Find out more info. Also, check Steve out on Instagram at Steve Byrne Live, and go to his YouTube page as well. You can watch his latest specials, which are crowd work specials, the first 10 minutes of his most recent special, which is a fascinating, unique concept, where he's taking the late night talk show model and incorporating that into a stand-up special and a whole lot more as well. You can also watch the Amazing Jonathan documentary there for free. Steve, real pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today. Safe travels to and from Austin this weekend.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure getting to speak with you. I'm sorry, these questions, I go a little long-winded sometimes, but if you ask, it's like, well, I might as well answer correctly. So appreciate that's it, what, man. Thanks for having me.
That's why I ask the questions. I appreciate the great answers, man.
That's right. All right. Well, hopefully we'll see you this weekend. Saturday will be the Hungover Show, because I'm sure I'll run into my good friend Tone Bell up there and tie one on. Jesus. Pray for my liver.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. For more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. Thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. Talk to you next time, Books on Pod.